Hello, you're listening to Queer Everything, a queer of color podcast about thriving in the world while being at odds with it. I'm Lena Rafiq Sheikh. It is my pleasure and delight to be on here with two old friends of mine, both Lebanese, both women, both doctors. Yana and Mesa met in medical school in Beirut many years ago. I jokingly call them the worst one-night stand ever because 18 years, two countries, several cities, and two children later, they're still going strong. Their story is really beautiful, and it has it all, from years of one having no idea that the other was pursuing them, to long distance before they could be together, and making hard decisions about love and career, navigating family and the world, and finally where they are now, which is bringing up their two little boys, starting with an adoption call that changed their lives forever. So why these two? It's not just that they're adorable and sweet together and make for a lovely story. I was 35 the first time I met a long-term lesbian couple in which the women were significantly older than me, like in their 70s. It brought to mind an Adrienne Rich quote about the consequences of invisibility and the lack of modeling that queer people have. It goes, "When those who have the power to name and socially construct reality choose not to see you or hear you, when someone with the authority of a teacher, say, describes the world and you are not in it, there's a moment of psychic disequilibrium, as if you looked in the mirror and saw nothing. It takes some strength of soul, and not just individual strength, but collective understanding, to resist this void, this non-being into which you are thrust, and to stand up, demanding to be seen and heard." As those who've been listening to the podcast know, part of this project is to offer our stories to people like us and to the world. We're here. We exist. There's a lot of us. And it is my pleasure and privilege to be able to share about who we are. Welcome. Hello, everybody. I'm so excited to be on here with two dear and old friends of mine, Yana and Mesa, who live in the Midwest adjacent city, which I'll let them tell you about. And the reason that I thought about having them on the podcast is because of their being contemporaries of mine, living in a similar part of the world that I did, and then being able to witness their process of starting a family, really being able to witness their story from early on and then seeing them come to this point. So I'm very excited to have the two of you on here. Would you introduce yourself briefly, maybe starting with you, Mesa?
My name is Mesa. I am Yana's wife. I'm a mom to two boys. I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Been here since 2012, and I'm pretty much a nerd.
Thank you. How about you, Yana?
I think Mesa didn't do herself justice. Mesa is a high-risk obstetrician. She's a wonderful doctor, in addition to everything she said. My name is Yana. I am a wife, mom, same two boys as Mesa. I am a medical oncologist. I take care of patients with cancer. I do a lot of research. I run a research lab, and I am a clinical trialist. And also, we're delighted to be on here because we've known you, I think, going on maybe 17 years now. And you've seen it all A to Z. So this is really a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
I'm so excited. In fact, when I was plotting the idea for the podcast, you two are among the first people that I thought of. So I'm so thrilled that this is finally happening. I may have mentioned to you, this season is about family. And there's so few examples of people from our part of the world like us having families and being in any way visible out there. So I'm also really excited from that perspective. When we talked just now, we talked about what the arc of the conversation would be. And I think it makes a lot of sense, as you said, to just start at the beginning, because the two of you have this wonderful meeting story, which I've heard from both of your perspectives and then together. And it's wonderful in the telling every single time. So would you tell us how you first met?
I would love to. So picture this, 2005 or seven?
Three.
Oh, Jesus. 2003. We're at a party. I see this vision across the pool. And Lena, you've heard me say this many times, and this is super cheesy. I absolutely fell in love with Mesa on first sight. And she then did not give me the time of day for like 5 years. And we were in the same medical school, and I'm asking people, what's her name? What's her story? I just felt so drawn to her for no discernible reason at the time, you know, to me. And I was just very insistent on meeting her. And I would try and speak to her at cafes and coffee shops. And she would always be like, why is this person pestering me? Like, she'd be hiding behind her newspaper at Café Najjar in Hamra. And I found out that she was moving to the States. By this point, we're in 2007. And I said, well, let's go big or go home. And I went on a pretty ruthless campaign, which I will not elaborate on your podcast, but those who know us know the details. And it worked out in my favor. And we fell very much in love. And that was almost 18 years ago. What's your version, baby?
Yeah, it's pretty close. Pretty close.
Please elaborate, please.
Yeah, I mean, I still remember that summer day, June of 2003, when I saw Yana at the beach party. I still remember where we were. And I remember being very, very intrigued by why she was talking to me. I could not understand why she was talking to me. And repeatedly in cafes and at the library, I could not grasp why she was talking to me until the spring of 2007, wow, when she made it pretty clear. And at that point, I was moving to the US to continue my training. And I thought, might as well leave with a bang, and and took a chance and put myself out there. And she did as well. And then since that first connection in April of 2007, we've been inseparable, I'd say, emotionally, even though we spent a bit of distance. We were at a bit of a distance geographically for a few years, but we've been together ever since.
I remember that. So there's a lot of very like gay elements to this story. First, the 5-year long slow burn where you had no idea what was going on. Excellent.
I knew what was going on. She didn't know what was going on. My sisters knew what was going on. Everybody and their mother knew what was going on. Mesa didn't. Sorry, Lena, go ahead.
Yes. And I jokingly have referred to you two as like the worst one night stand ever, because
we say it all the time.
We call it the longest one night stand.
So I know that, Yana, you were a few years behind Mesa in school. It was a few years before you came to the States. How did that work out? Because I remember there was a good chunk of time where the two of you were not geographically in the same place.
Yeah. Yana was 2 years behind in medical school. And when I graduated, I came to the States and landed in Washington, D.C. And Yana was still in Beirut. And for those 2 years we were apart, we didn't really have a prospect of how she was going to make it to the U.S. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have path, but we had very blind faith and a desire to really pursue the courtship, I would say. Mm-hmm. We spent an inordinate amount of time talking on the phone on the weekends when I wasn't working. And then we corresponded every single day because of the 7-hour time difference. I would wake up to an email from her with her thoughts and the things that have happened throughout her day. And then we would chat for a little bit in the afternoon. And then she would wake up with a summary of my daily events the following day. And we did that for 2 years. And we got to know each other with a lot of back and forth and a lot of stubbornness and a little bit of crazy.
A lot of crazy in hindsight. I mean, what were we thinking? Mesa was moving to the States, and she said, and to be clear, Lena, all joking aside, I never thought we'd be here. I really was, for lack of a better term, deeply in lust with this person. And then when Mesa said to me, I don't want this to end, would you try long distance? I thought, oh my God, she's crazy. I was alarmed. And then I thought, I also can't imagine this ending. Let's just try. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was a lot of crazy, because we had been together, what? A few short months when you moved.
3 months.
3 months.
Wow. Okay. So you had 3 months together and then you moved.
And then I left.
And then, Mesa came to the States. Mm-hmm. Well, you tell this part. Well, you go ahead.
And when the first time we saw each other after that was over the holidays. So we had after that initial 3 months, we were away from each other for a few months at a time. Mm-hmm. And then I started my training the following year, and we were able to find a way for Yana to come and spend a month in the US. as part of her medical school clinical training. And that was one of the happiest. So we got to live together for a month.
It was a dream.
And that was ended up feeling like a dream come true. We had spent so much time apart getting to know each other that it was a matter of just adapting to being in the same space. And it felt very natural. And on the last day of her month there, as we were starting to get really sad about not knowing when the next time we would spend a chunk of time together would be, Yana went to a job interview and was offered a position in DC to start the following year.
Wow.
And so that departure, that goodbye that year was the happiest we'd ever been saying bye to each other, because we knew that there was a way for her to be able to come back. And we knew that it was going to be in the same city and it would be an extension of this dream month that we had together.
That was October 9th of 2008. And I got on the red line to come to our house in DC from the NIH. And I was besides myself, to be very honest with you. Of course, I was besides myself because I was going to be with Mesa. But the scientists in me, I mean, I was truly besides myself. This was a postdoc at the National Cancer Institute. This was a personal dream. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I absolutely could not believe that I was going to be given the visa I needed to come here to do the work I wanted to do, to become a researcher, to become an oncologist, and to be with Mesa. It was genuinely one of the happiest days of my life, up there with having our babies. Because I could see it. I could see the path parting and I could see exactly how it was going to go for the first time.
When did you start that position?
July of 2009. I graduated medical school and I moved here literally the next day.
Wow. Okay. Okay. And then there was a period where you overlapped in DC. And then there was a period where you did not overlap.
We lived in DC for 2 years, which were truly blissful 2 years, genuinely. We had just the most wonderful time. In hindsight, in fact, we lived in a very, very tiny place and we were dirt poor, neither of which we realized at the time. We were over the moon to be together, so fulfilled with our work, so happy to be in the same house, right? Wouldn't you say, Mesa? Mm-hmm. And then remember at the time, even if we got married, this was not federally legally recognized. I had no recourse to stay in this country other than to get an H-1B visa, which I was offered at the Cleveland Clinic, which is obviously a fantastic place to go. So personally, that was a very difficult period because we were then separated from one another again for 3 years. But professionally, it turned out to be a wonderful thing for me.
3 years. Okay. And then it was after.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Mesa, do you want to tell the parts where you tried to come to Cleveland?
Well, yeah, we were constantly trying to meet each other and we were staggered levels of our training, but both pursuing specialty and then subspecialty training. And in every iterative application process, we tried to end up in the same place. And I tried to go to Cleveland for the next step in my training, and that didn't work out. But luckily, I ended up in Pittsburgh, which was at least a driving distance from Cleveland. And so we started seeing each other more frequently. And professionally speaking, that was a really great place to end up in for my training, and was very, ended up also being a good place for Yana to come for her training. So by then, after that second separation, we were very hell-bent on trying to make it to the same place. And fortunately, Pittsburgh professionally would allow us both to pursue our interests and to foster our careers without much compromise.
Without any compromise.
And allow us to be together. So we ended up in Pittsburgh.
I remember that. Yana, you were in my house when you decided between which positions to take. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. Remember going to dinner with you? I actually remember the restaurant we went to, oddly enough. I remember speaking with you a lot and ultimately going with my gut, which was I'm very over the distance and that's that. And I was, you know, I was like it was like a kamikaze mission to come to Pittsburgh. I told them this is my top choice. I mean, without putting you to sleep, the whole match thing is so out of your control. But I made it very clear to everyone in Pittsburgh that this is where, like, I was coming here or I was not going anywhere.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember at the end of the evening, you're like, this is not even a decision, is it? And you're like, no, this is ridiculous. Like, there's only one decision here.
I had the wonderful problem of having to make the choice between rankings at places like Harvard, which I think you remember. So it was, you know, not the easiest professional decision. But I will say in hindsight, I couldn't have done better for myself, I don't think. And really, none of that matters compared to the great personal joy that I've had with Mesa and having our children. So I'm so grateful that it really turned out so much for the best. But yeah, it was a very difficult decision.
What year was it that you adopted, got the call about the adoption?
2019.
Yeah, January 7th of 2019.
2019, okay. Because I remember that day, I'd woken up and I texted you and I said, hi, I had a dream about you. What's up? How are you? And you're like, I am in Michigan.
Yeah.
And this is what's happening. I was like, wow, okay. I had a little bit of an idea and not much of an idea.
We didn't have too much of an idea either.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So we decided that we were going to embark on starting a family in late spring, early summer of 2018.
Mm-hmm. And then I think we were in Morocco at the time, right?
Yeah, when
I
said during our Morocco trip.
Yeah.
And you'd been in Pittsburgh for how long at this point together?
Gianna came in 2014, so 4 years.
Yeah, 4 years. Okay.
Mm-hmm. 4 years. We had, Pittsburgh was a place we enjoyed living in. Gianna had finished her training. We were both faculty. We had bought a home. We had kind of settled in and felt very ready to take the next step. So in 2018, we made the decision to embark on expanding our family and going down the path of adoption.
Which we always wanted to do. We always said we would adopt our first baby.
Mm-hmm.
And started all the visitations and the paperwork and the home studies and all that fun in the early summer of 2018. And then went through the process of choosing an agency in October and went live in November of 2018. And then on January 7th, 2019, got an email from the agency about a potential match.
And just a tiny bit of background, Lena, when Mesa says going live, we felt very strongly, for reasons I won't take us on a tangent with, that we wanted to go through an open adoption so that we could tell our baby anything we knew about their birth parents and their story. And you can't do it with a closed adoption. So essentially our son's birth parents chose us to be his adoptive parents, which is obviously a sacred and beautiful thing. And so we had gone live and they had said to us, it's maybe a year and a half. And we said, okay, well, we're going to go to Kenya. We were planning a safari, actually. And I was sitting in this very chair in this very office when this email just blasted our world apart in the very best way on January 7th.
Monday.
Wow. Okay. And then how long until you were in Michigan?
One day.
Yeah.
So we got a call saying, telling us a potential match and that the birth parents really wanted us to be there at the time of birth and that the birth mom was going to be induced that Wednesday morning.
Wow.
And so we chatted with the birth mother that night on Monday night and introduced ourselves to each other and said, we'll see you on Wednesday.
Oh.
And we packed up the Christmas tree and packed up a couple of bags and scrambled to get a car seat and a bassinet from our friends on Tuesday and drove on Tuesday afternoon to Michigan.
I know. And now you see people who say things like, I'm not ready to have the baby. I don't have A, B, and C. In fact, you need nothing. In fact, you need diapers and a bassinet and milk. That's really it. And a car seat.
I remember talking to you in the initial days of when this was sort of unfolding. And what a cliff drop change it is.
Yeah. We went from not being parents to being parents in the blink of an eye. Genuinely. Okay. I can't say it was totally unexpected. We knew we were live on the adoption list, but the speed with which it happened for us was really very, very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this little 5-pound angel and we were there the whole day of his birth mom's labor. And he was born at 11:32 PM howling. And that was it. That was our Zane. And life is pre-Zane and post-Zane. And it's the most wonderful thing in the world. We don't remember talking to you in those days because Zane woke up every 40 minutes. I don't remember anything about that time.
Well, I mean, there was you all in the hotel. There was you all learning how to be 100% responsible with a baby. And then I remember texting with you that week when you were driving home. Yeah, it was absolutely mind-blowing.
Minus 32 Celsius in Michigan. Zane was tiny. He was 5,000 change. As you said, we were in a hotel. We didn't know how soon we'd leave Michigan. You have to wait for all the legalese to clear from Pennsylvania and Michigan before you can cross state lines. We moved hotels once in a district that they told us would be more favorable in terms of moving things along. Yeah. We had no clue. We're both doctors. We canceled clinics at the nth hour. It was pretty wild.
Wow. And then you were present for the birth. So which of you was the first one to hold him?
Mesa.
I was. I gave him his first bottle.
Wonderful. You know, what we didn't talk about earlier is I know that you each had a different process around coming out with family, degree of being open in your lives and what you navigated and all of that. And I have a sense, I don't have details, but I have a sense that it was obviously complicated with having a baby and making this decision. And as you mentioned earlier, doing this with no role models in mind. So either of you open to speaking to that side of it?
I'm trying to think where to start, because by the time we had Zane, I frankly didn't give a damn what anybody thought. And I had been living so openly for so long. I came out, and I really dislike the term, but I came out in, I don't know, really shortly after I met Mesa, I was guns blazing. I didn't care anymore. I just didn't care. Whereas pre-Mesa, this was something I tried to keep on the down low. But with Mesa, it was so different. I knew it was her, and I knew that my life was going to be with her, and I might as well, you know, face the music sooner rather than later. So I made no bones about it to anybody. Now, it didn't always go well, but that's how I did it. And I think there were degrees, you know. It was not easy at all in medical school. People were never to my face, but, you know, God knows what people said. Everybody who mattered knew about the relationship. My sisters were so supportive, always. Mm-hmm. They always had been. Friends knew, cousins knew. When we got married, so many of, you know, it was a small wedding and you were there, but most people there had flown in. Mm-hmm. How lovely is that, you know, for friends and family. I don't know. I just sort of ripped off the Band-Aid. That's how I did it. Do you think that's fair, Mesa?
Yeah. And we by the time we had kids, we had been together for so long. It had become a status, like our relationship had become the new status quo when it came to our parents. And our parents had visited our home and stayed with us. And kind of everything was in the open from that end. I think when we started the conversations about trying to have a family, and more so Yana than me, because I was too scared to have that conversation with my parents, mostly my dad, they also didn't have a role model of any of that in front of them. And so when we started, you know, we had a very little heads up about Zane's birth. When we called them that day, their initial reaction was very negative. They just couldn't fathom how that was possible. And they just could not imagine that being our life. So their reaction initially was not positive at all. And I remember my mom would call us when we were in Michigan to check in on the two of us to make sure we were okay. Wouldn't talk about like the life event that had happened and ask questions for a few months until she came to visit shortly after we came back from Michigan. She became more and more invested in Zane and Zane's well-being and came to see him when he was 3 months old. But there was a sort of breakdown in communication with the other three parents for the first few months of his life. And we essentially said, we're just calling to let you know what is happening, and what you choose to do and how much you choose to engage is your choice and your decision. But I need to go take care of my son. And so I don't have time to take care of you right now. And yeah, that was a conversation we had Monday night. We stayed up extra late Monday night so we could call them because our parents are also in Lebanon. And that was their reaction.
My reaction with my parents was a little bit different in the sense that they, you know, had ample heads up that this was happening. So it wasn't a bombshell that they knew. And I had told them for years that we were going to become parents. I think I started saying it to them around 16 or 17.
Wow.
And I wouldn't say their reaction was negative. I would say their reaction was more, we know this is what you want. We're very happy for you. We hope it's, but then they'd be like, are you sure this is what you want? And I'm like, Jesus, you know, if I was married to a man, would you be asking me that? Or just a bit of radio silence, which was very hurtful in its own way. I will say, at the end of the day, our kids' relationship with their grandparents is a love affair. They talk to all four every day. They've all been here multiple times. We've taken the kids home. I mean, now it's a whole other thing. But I just wanted to go back to say that by the time we had our kids, coming out was like, that was very old news.
Yes. And the reason I asked about that is because I think being the age that we are, it is extremely old news. And there are a lot of people from our respective parts of the world who are struggling now. In some ways, I think because the conversation is so public, maybe even in some ways worse than we might have, right? Time passing has not necessarily led to linear progress with the backlash that's happening now. So the reason that I ask is to get a sense of what each of your respective processes was like with yourselves, with people around you, with deciding the degree to which you do or don't care with family members, how you might handle difficult things, what you might tell a young person, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very helpful to feel very strong when it comes to people who have negative reactions, or even when you have questions about people's reactions when you're in a relationship and going through the process of coming out, right? Like, I think we had each other to be able to process ideas and thoughts and to rely on each other at the end of the day. And I think that, to me, was a source of solace and support during that whole initial process. And I think once you get to the point where, and we had this conversation, Yana, and you correct me if I'm remembering it wrong. Once you get to the point of thinking about having a family, there is a framework shift that happens in your mind of, I am willing to give up my whole connection to my past if I need to, in order to focus on a future with this child. If the people from the, you know, my country of origin are going to be opposed to this. And that's something that we wrestled with, and we recognized that we didn't know what it was going to look like to go back and visit Lebanon and share our experiences in Beirut and our family's homes and our adventures that we had in that country with our kids. We didn't know if that was going to be possible, but we had to be okay with that not being a possibility.
We went into it really not having all the answers. I don't want to make it sound like we came out and everything was hunky-dory and then we had these babies. Of course not. I really hope that's not how this is coming across. Coming out was a whole thing. And then over a decade later, we started to think about having our kids, which was a whole other thing. And we went into the second thing of having kids, not having the answers. We had adopted our Zane, our oldest, and we said, what are we going to tell people? What are we going to tell, you know, Teta o Amto, Khanto, Mabadi, I don't know who, in our villages? He was born and we still didn't know. And then I carried our second child. I was pregnant. How on earth am I going to explain that? You know, you say you adopted a child, that's one thing. You're pregnant, that's a whole other thing. So I was pregnant and I gave birth, still not knowing how I was going to explain anything. But ultimately, it didn't matter. Or of course it matters, but it didn't matter to me. Because at the end of the day, I have built my life the only way that it's going to be true to me. And that's what's going to be with a woman. Thank God it was Maisa, with these boys. And to this day, if you put me in my dad's village, I don't know what I'll say. I have no idea. I probably won't explain. And if anyone asks a question, I'll probably answer very openly. Because the one thing I've never done and will never do is lie about my family. But make no bones, we don't have the answers. We didn't know how it would be when we went to Lebanon until we actually went to Lebanon a few months ago with the kids.
Yeah.
We're like, we don't know what's going to happen.
Go ahead, Maisa, please.
Yeah, you just figure it out. But I think when you speak with other parents, you essentially, it's a DIY project that you are raising these kids, you are re-raising yourself, you are learning about this new capacity that you have, and you're engaging with the world all while you're doing it. There isn't I think, a right way or wrong way or a different way of doing things. It just depends. There's so much context that comes with every single family, because every single family is just a little bit different. And our family is, I think, a very interesting one when it comes to like experiencing Lebanon. Zayn, mm-hmm. our firstborn, is of Korean and Micronesian background. And our youngest son looks like a white American, like a conflict. And going to Lebanon and engaging with like the immigration when you first walk in was really interesting. Thankfully, all five members of that conversation were extremely tired, the four of us and him. So it ended up just being very comedic.
He was very confused.
Was he?
He couldn't gather like what the equation was or who was what. And then the boys were being slightly whiny because they were tired from a transatlantic voyage. And so we suggested that they may spend some time with him if they didn't want to leave the airport. And that, I think, set off a comedic chain of jokes between everyone, with the boys not wanting to stay, the gentleman threatening for them to stay throughout his whole shift, which was 24 hours long, us saying, yeah, we'll see you tomorrow, and ended up just being a big laugh. And at the end, even though both kids carry Yana's last name, he looked at me asking if I was willing to travel with him by myself again.
But the kids have your middle name, and you could see that the guy couldn't, I should say the kid's middle name is Mesa's last name. And the guy just couldn't piece it together. So at one point I said, we're together and these are our children. And then I was like, well, the shoe's going to drop, but you know, we're not idiots. We didn't go until I had a U.S. passport. Because, you know, we're so, how do you say it, Admin?
Progressive.
We're so progressive that, you know, you catch a guy with a bad day. I think legally he could jail me if he wanted to. So right. We waited until we had our U.S. passport. So that made me feel maybe a false reassurance, but it gave me some reassurance that would be okay. Mm-hmm. Not to say the U.S. is a civilized place these days. I want to be very clear, but you know what I'm saying.
Sure. Yes. You're not as subject to the whims of passport control.
Immigration officers and passport control. Yeah. Not as much. Yeah.
Not as much. Huh. So you had Zayn. When he was how old did you make the decision to become pregnant and carry?
It was the middle of COVID. I don't know what we were thinking.
The following year, 2020.
Wow.
So again, we thought the process was going to be a lengthy process. We thought it's going to take a while.
I was pushing 36, I think, right?
And so we said, let's start it in, you know, late 2020. And then this was the summer of 2020. It will probably, by the time he's like somewhere between 2 and 3, it'll be nice to have a sibling from the point of view of age difference. November of 2020, Yana got pregnant. And our second son, Noor, was born in July of 2021.
Because, you know, amazing. Two doctors in the middle of COVID with a toddler. What was missing? Another child.
A two-year-old, no less.
But you amazing. Know, he's an angel.
We now know our timelines.
I feel like you know them.
Okay, so then there's the two of them. And you just went to Lebanon this past, just a few months ago. What was that visit like after you got through immigration?
It was wonderful. We had, honestly, we had a ball. We split our time between Mesa's parents' house, and because they have, you know, a mountain house and a beautiful garden. And my parents' house is about 20 minutes down the same mountain. So we just shuttled up and down this mountain. We took the kids to our favorite restaurants. We took them to Munir and Butoni, and they had all the food we love, and they played on the Staiha and all the extended family. And it was just wonderful. And we had been hoping to go back now, but we're hopefully going to go back. I know. We're hopefully going to go back next summer. Mesa, how was it for you?
It was a blast. It was a blast. So right after the passport control funness, we went out and my parents met us at the airport with their driver. And this is the same driver that they've had since I was 3. So he kind of knows our whole family. And the second introduction of our family happened in the parking lot where the driver was trying to figure out who was what, where, and when. And this driver is a member of our family, really. Like,
just so you were not out to the driver at this point.
Yeah, so we had to do that as a second, just like within 15 minutes of passport control, that was the immediate next introduction, because we split up into two cars because we had too many suitcases. And
one kid is yelling for mama and yelling for mommy. And this guy just looked very confused.
And this driver doesn't speak any English. And so he's chatting with me in Arabic. And he's like, your dad didn't tell me you got married. And I was like, okay. And he's like, and you never told me that you had any kids. I would have gotten the kids' toys and everything. And I said, it's okay. It's totally understandable. He's like, he never tells me anything. I was like, it's okay. And he was like, but can you tell me a little bit? So I know her, Jan. I know her. I've met her before.
Who's been around?
Whose kid? And I was like, look, they're both of our kids. That's Noor. This is Zain. And he goes, two women with kids? How does that happen? And I said, you know, with a little help, you can get a lot of things done these days. And he cracked up. And Zain responded in Arabic, that's so funny. And he looked at him and he said, you speak Arabic?
Wow.
And he said, of course I speak Arabic. And he was like, welcome. That's it. That's the end of it. You speak Arabic? Oh. That's all I needed to know.
Both our boys' first language is Arabic, which is the one hill we were dying on with raising them. Sorry, go ahead, baby.
And then that was it. For the rest of the trip there, he had no questions, absolutely beyond the fact that he was satisfied with that conversation.
Amazing. Oh, how wonderful.
And Lebanon was great because the house in which we stayed, my parents' house, is the house where we've been summering since I was very young. And it's in the neighborhood in a village that I've spent every single summer since I was four, from between when I was four and when I was 25. Mm. So I had a lot of personal memories and spaces that I got to share with them. That to me just brought, it was just very satisfying. It was just so wonderful to see the kids in that space and to see the kids with the parents, the grandparents all together. In the garden with the chickens, just all the things I grew up doing.
Beautiful. Oh, Yana, you were going to say.
No, Mesa said it.
Oh, beautiful. That's really lovely. So when I tell people that I know you two and you live in Pittsburgh, I always have a little bit of a moment because I went to college in Pittsburgh and it is an extremely different place than it was when I was there, including being delightfully, beautifully, from what I can tell on my visits to you all, queer friendly. What has it been like raising your family in Lawrenceville of all places? Lawrenceville was such a dump in the early 2000s. Let me tell you, it was not like the mecca of cool that it is today.
It's been wonderful. I mean, I've never had any issue. I've never had any problem. Nobody seems to bat an eyelash. I think by virtue of what I do, I see patients from all over the country. They always assume it's a husband, and I think, you know, I understand most people who see me assume I'm straight and always take that as an opportunity to widen people's horizons. And I've really never had a problem to my face, at least. It's been a wonderful place to raise our boys.
That's great.
Yeah. Pittsburgh has this very interesting history, I think, like in the American fabric, both positive and negative. It's very representative of, I think, US's path in the 20th century. But from the point of view of our experience in the city, we've really never felt anything but welcomed and felt anything but ease in living here.
That is delightful to hear. So then the thing that's sitting with me that you both said when we opened this conversation, Mesa, you talked about how doing this thing, you did it without any idea of how any role models. And Yana, you called it the thing that you're most proud of.
It is categorically the thing I'm most proud of.
A lot of people listen to this podcast because, again, I think our stories don't get represented very much. What would you say to young people who are queer, maybe in that part of the world, maybe not in that part of the world, and earlier on their journeys around coming to terms with themselves, visualizing their life, picturing a future? Or what would you say to your young selves?
It's a very big question, Lena, and I want to try and do it justice, although I'm not sure I can. What I would say to a young person, and I've had, not on any social media anymore, but I was for a while, and I would always get messages on Instagram from people who identify somewhere on on the spectrum of sexuality or whatever. Ask, you know, I heard about you from so-and-so. I heard about you from this person. I heard about you from that person. And I thought, if nothing else, what a wonderful thing that somebody has seen a successful outcome. And by successful, I mean, we bucked the rules. We stayed together. Mm-hmm. We had our children. What I would say to a younger person is, don't make yourself small. I think for a very long time, I convinced myself I didn't want to have children. And that's, in hindsight, I think it's because I never understood how it could happen for me. And in fact, I had my kids, like we talked about earlier, still not understanding how it would happen for me. I would say, don't be afraid to go after the things you really want. And at the end of the day, you have nobody. You're not accountable to anybody but yourself and the person you choose to spend your life with. And this is something I was very cognizant of when I didn't know how it was going to turn out with my family, not my sisters, but my parents. I thought, I'm going to be, God willing, if I live that long, 65, and whose head is going to be on the pillow next to me? It's going to be Mesa. It's going to be whoever I spend my life with. And I let that be my guiding light. People say to me all the time, I'll never tell my parents. They'll never accept. Even if I have children, they'll never accept. You know, that may all be true, but you still have to live your own life for yourself. When you're on your deathbed, it's going to be your spouse, if you're lucky, not your parents. But, you know, these are just things I always held to be so true. And that's really what guided me through a lot of difficulty, which is not to say I don't adore my parents. You know how close I am to them. So I would say, don't make yourself small.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would probably say that you need to spend some time thinking about what you want, not just what is around you and what you've seen, but what you really want. Like, I spent a lot of time not being open with myself about my sexuality when I was young, but I always knew I wanted to be a parent. That was a recurrent theme that I had my whole life. And I tried to remind myself, kind of regardless of what the circumstance was, even before I knew if I would have a partner, what kind of partner I would have, that this is something that I really wanted. This was a central desire of mine, and to try to keep that in mind and to communicate that openly in circumstances. And you have to be vulnerable too. I mean, I think when you're coming from our region of the world and you're someone who is gay or queer or even just non-conforming with the heteronormative life that you're surrounded by, you have to recognize that you are different. You have to try to understand how, try to find people, even if you find people who are not same as you, if you find people who are different than the norm, then you will have some similarities in your experiences that you can bond over. And recognize that that vulnerability is not necessarily weakness. You know, you're vulnerable because you are going down a path that is different than what you've been exposed to and what you've experienced. And that's okay. The strength to try to overcome that, if it's something you really want, is something that will build up over time and that you'll realize after the fact. Sometimes you just have to jump in so that you don't make yourself small. That's how you grow. You don't grow by gaining the strength and gaining the support and gaining the community and then making the jump. The jump itself is what gives you the strength. Put in a circumstance where you have to make a call and have to say, I just want to let you know I'm driving to Michigan tomorrow because Yana and I have been chosen to be the parents of this child. And then stop right there, regardless of what the reaction is. That you sometimes you just have to make, you have to say some things out loud, and then you have to force yourself to believe them after the fact.
Mesa used to always say to me, and you still say to me, even though, thank God, we've been so blessed, and I don't know how it could get better, but you always said to me, stick with me, the best is yet to come. She said it to me from day one. I'd say, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And she said, stick with me, the best is yet to come. And then it did. And we've had a lot of heartache, a lot of difficulty, a lot of estrangement, a lot of alienation, a lot of months not speaking with very dearly loved ones. We've had parents not at weddings. We've had parents not present when our kids were born. None of this is meant to be a rosy, you know, falsely rosy picture. But what I want to say is, living my own truth as a gay woman is the only way that I could have lived authentically and happily. And our bravery, hand in hand, has paid me back in spades in terms of joy. Every day I get to go home to Mesa and these two boys. And that's on the back of a lot of difficulty. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Beautiful. So you said the first little while was hard with your parents when you first had Zane. What changed? How did it change?
I think for my parents, it's not that they weren't supportive. They, like I said, they knew it was coming. I think they just didn't know how to be. And in hindsight, when I've really had these conversations with them after the fact to say, hey, where were you? They think they were giving us space. And I've tried to explain to them that's really not what we needed at all. We needed the opposite of space. We needed everybody there with us. How it got better was, I think, time. And they started to, well, we came out of the blur of becoming parents to a newborn, and we were more present to them. Like, we could make overtures, like trying to call or making the effort or picking up the phone or texting, which, you know, in the first months, there was just zero. It's kind of like, I don't want to say like a stand, but I was like, seriously, I have a newborn. Like, if you can't text me, I can't text you. And so we were at the stalemate for a while, but then they were visiting. Not long after they were visiting us, we've spent every Christmas of Zane's life with them somewhere or other. I think except for the very first one, because we were working and we couldn't travel. They've all been here many times. It just changed with time. I don't know. Do you have a better answer, Maisa?
Well, I think even though we were, I think their initial reaction was shock. More than anything else. It was just shock. We were, I think, giving them a reality that they had never been exposed to and that they couldn't wrap their heads around. And even though it was we were very matter of fact, you don't want to talk to us, that's fine. You let me know when you're ready. When they would reach out, we were very open and welcoming. So we didn't hold a grudge or try to blame them for their reaction. And I think we did the same thing initially with any negative reaction they've ever had. We've always been like, look, you needed your space. I understand. I'm not going to give you a hard time that you needed a space. Let's just move on at this point. And that process was accelerated with the kids because we were just so tired while taking care of the kids. We just didn't have the energy to have a back and forth. I remember having conversations with my dad. I mean, my dad expressed a fear and concerns that we would lose our jobs, that, and I reassured him that, in fact, we had parental leave from our jobs to take care of our kid.
Interesting.
And then he expressed fears of what the family members would say. And I said, you know, I'm happy to tell them myself about just to do that. And I reached out to my aunts and uncles and said, I've adopted a kid with Yana. This is his picture. We'd love for you to meet him someday.
Wow.
And when he realized that everybody didn't have as a negative reaction and that the family was supportive and welcoming, at least to my face, he was able to relax and he was able to start focusing on rebuilding a relationship. And so by the time Zane was 6 months, I remember, or even by the time Zane was 4 months old, he sent me a message one day asking me how everybody was, and he asked to see a picture. And that was the real thaw that happened in that breakdown communication. But yeah, I think we were welcoming. We were like, and we've always had this understanding, I think Yana and I, of we expect of them to let us live our own truth and our own life and to have that independence of practice. We also have that same expectation of them. I don't expect my parents to change their life or to, I don't have preset expectations for how they talk about me and my life within their space and their community, because I don't live there. I live very far away from there and I don't have to deal with the consequences of that community.
Right.
And so I just let them decide. And even when we went back to Lebanon this year, one of the conversations we had on the phone was, you know, do you feel comfortable with us staying in your house? And they're like, of course. Kids, you, Yana, everybody's going to be there. There's no question you're not going to be somewhere else. And we're like, okay, that's totally fine. And I think at one point one of us said, how are you going to explain any of this? And they literally said, there's nothing to explain. There's you, there's Yana, there's the kids. If anybody wants to ask a question, we'll see what the question is and then we'll answer it accordingly.
Okay.
Maisa's parents have been so lovely and matter of fact at this point. He told everybody in her village that his daughters were visiting, which really I think maybe left people even more confused. You know, to this day, I have no doubt our parents struggle. And I won't speak for Maisa, I'll speak for mine. My mom has asked me many times, what should I tell so-and-so? And, you know, if I'm in an unkind mood, perhaps, or an uncharitable mood, my response is, I don't care. Mm-hmm. But my usual response is, tell them whatever you're comfortable with. You know, no one's ever made up a husband, that much I know. I think to some people, I've adopted these children, but to all of the nuclear, or not adopted, you know, adopted and had, but then to everybody of any import, aunts, uncles, any extended family of any significance, my mom hosted these lovely dinners over the summer. They all came. They met my son, the kids. What does my mom say at a dinner party about her grandkids? I don't know. But honestly, I don't particularly care.
Well, I think it might be interested in knowing, but I think it's their predicament. It's their choice and their decision. And I'm okay with that. I don't recognize the relationship they have with the grandkids. And I also recognize the constraints of the community that they have.
Yeah. And I think it would be really, really obnoxious and American to say, oh, well, they should tell everybody. No, of course not. That's just not the part of the world we're from. They should tell whoever, whatever they're comfortable with. I'm okay with that. I don't judge them whatsoever. Like I said earlier on, the one thing I've never done is lie about my family. And I've said to my mom, good friends, she'd be like, they're asking me questions. I don't know what to say. I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. I've said, just tell them to call me. And people that my mom thought would be totally unreceptive have been like, listen, I don't say wife in Lebanon. I say, this is my partner. We've been together 18 years. These are our kids. And people are just delighted and loving. And I've really never had a problem. So it's kind of a direct questions to me, mom, situation.
That's where I am with my father. I've said to him, like, okay, if you're going to make me hang out with your friends, just be aware, I'm not going to lie about who I am or my life. Last question. You two have been together for 18 years and still going strong. And really, like, from what I can tell from all external appearance, like, going strong since the beginning. What is your secret?
Are you going first or am I?
You're smiling. Go ahead.
I am sincerely madly in love with you. You know that. And no relationship is always roses. We have our ups and downs like anybody else, especially two young kids. Mm-hmm. I think the secret is to talk to each other, to communicate. That's the biggest cliche, but it's so true. Mm-hmm. And then to be very, very kind, even if you are disagreeing or even if you're grumpy. I think if one of us ever called the other, you know, the B word, I think, oh my God, it's all over, because you've lost respect and kindness. I don't know how you come back from that. Date each other. That's a really big one. We go on date nights all the time. We have a big date night tomorrow. We're very excited. Woo each other. Compliment each other. Don't take each other for granted. Try for one another. Travel alone. Maisa, what's our secret?
You know, honestly, I think, and I say this to you all the time, I think the fact that we took so long being together and getting to know each other kind of at a slow pace and that distance really forced us to do all the things that Yana was talking about. Like trying to build a relationship while you are seven time zones away from each other. One is in medical school and one is in medical training. Requires a lot of effort and requires you to develop communication skills. And it forces you to be both patient and stubborn at the same time. And I think relationships, if you can be both patient and stubborn about the relationship itself, it can help you build a foundation that you can just take through the different trials of life, where you get tested and the relationship gets tested. And you fall back on it. You start realizing that, you know, this is the person that I love, and this is the person that I know, and these are the things that we struggle with, and this is how we come back from conflict together. Adjustment that I make in my behavior that brings about this behavior in her. You get to learn all of these soft skills that you over time build into a relationship. I mean, a relationship just takes a lot of time. I think a big part of why we still go strong now is we took our time. We took our time with decision making. We allowed each other space when it came to big conversations or big decisions. We tried, you know, the back and forth from different places was to, we talked about like the story of how we got together, and it seems very linear that we ended up together, but some of those conversations allowed for freedom of one person going to somewhere else and not prioritizing the relationship if professional ventures had to take the lead, and be okay with that and to feel both confident in that and patient and stubborn. Like, I'm going to be 6 hours away by car, but we're still going to see each other once a month. It's just the way it's going to be. And I think this, you have the expectation that on a whole level, you're going to have a fantastic life together. But on a day-to-day level, not every single moment is going to be fantastic. And you're going to try to constantly draw your day-to-day interactions towards that fantastic. But life sometimes has other demands and schedules and kids and sickness and all that funness. But you're going to strive for that fantasticness on the whole constantly. You're going to remember what it feels like when things are fantastic and try to strive towards it.
I also think it's really important to turn towards each other. If Maisa speaks to me, I'm not looking at my phone while listening to her. I actually look at her and listen to her, and vice versa. It sounds so obvious, but I think a lot of people just don't really listen to each other anymore. And there's one other thing that I wanted to say. Oh, being together after 18 years is a very active choice. There have absolutely been times in our relationship where we're like, halas, halas. And then you just take a step back and you look at the whole thing and you look at the arc of the whole thing and you get through it, which is not to say you should get through misery. Of course not. But I'm saying every relationship takes work to get through the tough times. And if you are very, very lucky, on balance, it's a lot more joy than difficulty. And that's what we've been blessed enough to have. We've grown in very different ways. You know how gung-ho we both are about our work. I have to be honest, to this day, when I think of myself, the first time I said wife, mom, doctor, I still think of myself as a doctor first and foremost. That's just the first thing that comes to my head. And Maisa has been so supportive of my career in ways I could have never gotten to where I am without her. I like to think I'm also her biggest cheerleader. And we have a lot of fun. We make each other laugh. We laugh at one another. That's really important. But the short answer to everything is Maisa's just really sexy, and that's what's kept me around.
Same.
Excellent.
Same. Yeah. I think it's, yeah. Thanks.
It's true.
You make her blush. It's great.
Still after 18 years. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the way to stay together while you're building a family is to think of things as expanding, not things being taken away. It's a lot of parents, my parents, when I asked them, how do you go about when we were transitioning from one to two kids, how do you, because it's hard to imagine loving multiple kids the same way you love your firstborn. And then second kid is born, all of a sudden you feel your capacity expand. Both from the point of view of energy and taking care of two kids and love for two kids. And I really like that visual when it comes to thinking about how life in general, you just expand. You just expand to allow for more things to happen. You don't necessarily have to take things away in order to make room for different things. If you're able to think of things in a way that you are expanding, then you're not necessarily compromising something all the way and it's being subtracted from your life. It's just allowing for more things to come into be. And so I've expanded myself to be a part of a relationship. Then we expanded the relationship to have a family, and then we grew our family. And all of that is built on that foundation, but that foundation was strong enough. And then over time, doesn't take away from my interests and my identity, it just adds on to it. And I think the same thing goes for Jana. I think you just keep adding. You think of things as being added, not things being taken away.
I think if you had to distill everything we just said into one word, honestly, if I had to pick only one thing, and I think you'll agree with me, Maisa.
Dance party.
Kind.
Dance parties.
We have a lot of dance parties. That's true. But I also think being kind is the single most important thing. You know, one lovely thing, Lena, that we didn't talk about is we said how difficult it was when we had Zane. When we had Mood, when we told everyone I was pregnant, all we got, 4 out of 4 grandparents, was happiness. They were thrilled. My mom has been gunning for a third, and I think she spent 2 months with us and she saw the chaos we live in, and I think she's dropped the campaign. But it's just amazing how things turn, honestly, how things come around.
Beautiful. Any last thoughts, either of you?
Just that I love you very much, Mason.
Yeah, I love you too. A lot, a lot.
Also, am I making dinner or are you?
Beautiful. Thank you both for making the time to come on here to share your story, to share yourselves. I had a lot of respect for the way the two of you are with one another and how you show up in the world and how you two have been so intentional and strong and brave in building your life to be exactly the way that you want it to be. It's been beautiful to watch it unfold, and it's beautiful to see where it is now. Wonderful to see you two really happy together. So thank you.
Thank you, Lena.
Thank you, Lena. Thank you, Lena, for having this platform too.
You heard them, folks. Dance parties and kindness. To turn to something more serious, we've recorded the last several episodes of this podcast in the wake of Israel's ongoing genocide and displacement of Palestinian people, funded and enabled by the United States. I'm recording this the night before the ICJ case in January 2024, and this episode will drop as it is ongoing. I am married to a South African, and I cannot tell you how proud I am of that in this moment. I want to express my solidarity to all of you who have been steadfast in your resistance, even as your hearts are breaking anew every day, who are showing up again and again to spread awareness by telling and amplifying Palestinian stories, who are making calls you should not be having to make, having conversations you should not be fucking having to have, and protesting things that we should not be having to protest. I see you, I love you, and I stand with you now and always. We are queer as in fuck your bullshit justifications for genocide and land theft, especially the pinkwashing ones. We see right through it. Free Palestine.